Hello, this is Jean reading the New York Times for Thursday, April 25, 2024. From the front page, Supreme Court appears sharply divided in emergency abortion case by Abby Van Sickle. The Supreme Court appeared sharply divided on Wednesday over whether federal law should allow doctors to perform emergency abortions in states with near total bans on the procedure, in a case that could determine access to abortion in emergency rooms across the country. The lively two-hour argument focused on a clash between Idaho, whose law limits access to abortion unless the life of the pregnant woman is in danger, and federal law. Questioning by justices suggested a divide along ideological and possibly gender lines. What Idaho is doing is waiting for women to wait and deteriorate and suffer the lifelong health consequences with no possible upside for the fetus, said Solicitor General Elizabeth B. Preluger, arguing on behalf of the federal government. It just stacks tragedy upon tragedy. Justice Elena Kagan interjected that the current situation seemed untenable. It can't be the right standard of care to force somebody onto a helicopter. Although the collision between the two laws affects only those women who face dire medical complications during pregnancy, a broad decision could have implications for more than a dozen states that have enacted near-total bans on abortion since the court overturned a constitutional right to abortion in Dobbs v. Jackson Women's Health Organization in June 2022. The dispute was the second time in less than a month that the Supreme Court has grappled with abortion. It is a potent reminder that even after Justice Samuel A. Alito Jr. vowed in 2022 that the issue would return to elected representatives, it continues to make its way back to the court. In late March, the justices considered the availability of the abortion pill, mifepristone. The federal law at issue, the Emergency Medical Treatment and Labor Act, or EMTALA, enacted by Congress in 1986, mandates that hospitals receiving federal funds provide patients with stabilizing care. Under Idaho's near-total ban on abortion, the procedure is illegal except in cases of incest, rape, some instances of non-viable pregnancies, or when it is necessary to prevent the death of the pregnant woman. Doctors who perform abortions could face criminal penalties, prison time, and loss of their licenses to practice medicine. The Biden administration maintains that the federal law conflicts with and should override Idaho's. Lawyers for the state contend that the administration has improperly interpreted the federal law in a way that would bypass state bans. Abortion opponents assert the Biden administration is trying to use the federal law to turn hospitals into legal abortion sites in states where the procedure is mostly banned. Several of the conservative justices appeared skeptical of the federal government's argument that the decades-old law aimed at preventing patient dumping, hospitals refusing to treat the poor and uninsured, should override Idaho's abortion restrictions. How can you impose restrictions on what Idaho can criminalize simply because hospitals in Idaho have chosen to participate in Medicare? Justice Alito asked. The three liberal justices pushed back strongly on the lawyer arguing for Idaho, Joshua N. Turner, broaching several examples of pregnant women facing severe complications that could leave them unable to have children or with debilitating injuries. They also cited recent reports that since Idaho's ban went into effect, hospitals have flown several women to other states to receive emergency abortion care. Justice Amy Coney Barrett, a conservative, joined the tough questioning. Justice Sonia Sotomayor appeared skeptical of Mr. Turner's argument that the state's law allows for doctors to make a good faith determination about whether a patient's life is in danger, describing a patient whose water broke early and required a hysterectomy and abortion. She can no longer have children, Justice Sotomayor said. All right, you're telling me the doctor there couldn't have done the abortion earlier? Again, it goes back to whether a doctor can, in good faith medical judgment, Mr. Turner began. That's a lot for the doctor to risk, Justice Sotomayor replied. just as Barrett asked what would happen if a local prosecutor did not agree with a doctor's judgment that an abortion was necessary. When Mr. Turner answered that it is very case by case, Justice Barrett joined in, "I'm kind of shocked, actually, because I thought your own expert had said below that these kinds of cases were covered," she said. Even as Mr. Turner responded that such cases would be covered if a doctor acted in good faith, Justice Barrett continued to probe. "What if the prosecutor thought differently?" she asked. "What if the prosecutor thought, well, I don't think any good faith doctor could draw that conclusion?" "That, Your Honor, is the nature of prosecutorial discretion, and it may result in a case," Mr. Turner said. An extended exchange between Justice Alito and Ms. Preliger raised a broader question about whether some of the conservative justices may be prepared to embrace the language of fetal personhood, that is, the notion that a fetus would have the same rights as a pregnant woman. Justice Alito, who had relied on the language of fetal personhood in writing the court's majority opinion in Dobbs, noted that one potentially very important phrase had not been mentioned, the federal law's reference to the woman's quote-unquote unborn child. "Isn't that an odd phrase to put in a statute that imposes a mandate to perform abortions?" Justice Alito asked. "Have you ever seen an abortion statute that uses the phrase unborn child?" Ms. Preliger responded that it made sense in terms of that federal law, because it was an attempt to ensure that hospitals treated both a pregnant woman and the fetus in an emergency medical situation. The Biden administration has relied on EMTALA as a narrow way to challenge state-level abortion bans. After the court overturned a constitutional right to an abortion, near-total bans on the procedure swiftly took effect in some states, including in Idaho. Once the Republican-controlled legislature in the state passed the Defense of Life Act, which makes it a crime to perform or assist in performing an abortion, the Biden administration sued the state in August 2022, arguing that federal law should trump the state law when the two directly conflict. The federal law specifies that a hospital must provide care to a person with an emergency medical condition. For pregnant women, the law states, that means when the absence of immediate medical attention could reasonably be expected to jeopardize the health of the woman or her unborn child. If a hospital breaks the federal law, it can be sued and potentially lose Medicare funding. The federal law also includes a provision that it will not preempt a state or local law unless the requirement directly conflicts with it. But the state law imposes a prison sentence of up to 5 years if it is violated, and can lead to the loss of a doctor's medical license. A federal trial judge temporarily blocked the state's ban. Last fall, a 3-judge panel from the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Ninth Circuit put the ruling on hold and reinstated the ban. But that decision was ultimately overridden by an 11-member panel of the appeals court, which temporarily blocked Idaho's law as the appeal continued. Outside the Supreme Court on Wednesday, demonstrators gathered at competing rallies. Melissa Farmer, 43, who said she was denied an abortion in Missouri and Kansas after her water broke at 17 weeks, spoke in support of the federal law's protections. "I just don't want anyone else to go through what I did," Ms. Farmer said. "That's why I'm speaking out, because it's so wrong and I don't see any kind of light." Just steps away, about a dozen anti-abortion demonstrators raised signs that read, "Abortion betrays women," and "Emergency rooms are not abortion clinics." What this law would do is it essentially make our hospitals and emergency rooms abortion clinics. Bethany Jansen, 30, the founder of an anti-abortion group, said of the federal law, "And that's a problem." In other legal news, Arizona charges Giuliani and other Trump allies in election interference case by Danny Hakem and Maggie Haberman. Rudolph W. Giuliani, Mark Meadows, and a number of others who advised Donald J. Trump during the 2020 election were indicted in Arizona on Wednesday, along with all of the fake electors who acted on Mr. Trump's behalf there to try to keep him in power despite his loss in the state. Boris F. Stein, one of Mr. Trump's top legal strategists, was also among those indicted, a complication for Mr. Trump's defense in the criminal trial that began this week in Manhattan over hush money payments made to a porn star, Stormy Daniels. The indictment includes conspiracy, fraud, and forgery charges related to alleged attempts by the defendants to change the 2020 election results. Arizona is the fourth swing state to bring an elections case involving the activities of the Trump campaign in 2020, but only the second after Georgia to go beyond the fake electors whom the campaign deployed in swing states lost by Mr. Trump. The former president, who is seeking another term, was also named an unindicted co-conspirator in the Arizona case. I understand for some of you today didn't come fast enough, and I know I'll be criticized by others for conducting this investigation at all, Chris Mays, Arizona's Democratic Attorney General, said in a recorded statement. But as I have stated before, and will say here again today, I will not allow American democracy to be undermined. It's too important. Mr. Giuliani is Mr. Trump's former personal lawyer. Mr. Meadows was the White House chief of staff at the time of the 2020 election. They were among a number of defendants whose names were redacted from the indictment, though it was clear from the context and the descriptions who they were. For example, the passage referencing Mr. Giuliani, the former mayor of New York City, said, among other things, that he was known as the mayor. Some parts of the indictment did not refer to Mr. Trump by name, instead referring to the defendant's attempts to declare unindicted co-conspirator 1 and Pence the winners of the 2020 presidential election. Also indicted were Mike Roman, a Trump campaign operative in 2020, John Eastman, an architect of the fake electors' plan, and two other lawyers who advised Mr. Trump and his 2020 campaign, Jenna Ellis and Christina Bob. The indictment lays out a series of alleged efforts by the defendants to overturn Arizona's election results. They are accused of pressuring officials responsible for certifying election results to encourage them to change the election results, including the governor, the legislature, and the Maricopa Board of Supervisors. In all, 35 people who acted as fake electors in Georgia, Michigan, Nevada, and now Arizona face criminal charges for signing certificates in 2020, falsely stating that Mr. Trump had won their state's electoral votes. Mr. Giuliani, Mr. Meadows, Mr. Roman, and Mr. Eastman now face charges in two states, Georgia and Arizona. Ms. Ellis has already pleaded guilty to a felony in Georgia. Among those charged in Arizona are some who served as top Republican Party officials there during the 2020 election, including Kelly Ward, a former state party chairwoman, and Greg Sasten, who at the time was executive director of the state party. Two state senators, Anthony Kern and Jake Hoffman, now also face charges. Some of the people who held themselves out to be Trump electors in states that he lost in 2020 have adamantly insisted that they were acting legally. After Dr. Ward and other fake electors gathered in Phoenix that December, she wrote in a social media post that, "We are the electors who represent the legal voters of Arizona." As recently as late last year, Mr. Kern said that there's no such thing as fake electors. Late Wednesday, Charles Burnham, a lawyer for Mr. Eastman, said, "The phenomenon of partisan lawfare grows more troubling by the day. Professor Eastman is innocent of the criminal conduct in Arizona or any other place, and will fight these charges as he has all the other unjust accusations leveled against him." Ted Goodman, a spokesman for Mr. Giuliani, said, "The continued weaponization of our justice system should concern every American as it does permanent, irrevocable harm to the country." Mr. Hoffman said in a social media post that he was innocent of any crime, adding that, "I will vigorously defend myself, and I look forward to the day when I am vindicated of this disgusting political persecution." Mr. Epstein was a constant presence during Mr. Trump's civil trial in January on charges that he had defamed the New York writer E. Jean Carroll. He joined Mr. Trump at the defense table when Mr. Trump's lawyer in the case went to the bench for sidebars. But Mr. Epstein has not been in New York for the current criminal case. He has described himself as in-house counsel to Mr. Trump and has been something of a quarterback for the various legal teams working on the former president's defenses in four criminal cases. He usually speaks with Mr. Trump several times a day. Mr. Epstein has been arrested twice in Arizona over the last 10 years, once in 2014 for assault after a bar fight, in which he pleaded guilty and the conviction was set aside, and again in 2021 after he was accused of inappropriately touching two women. In that case, he pleaded guilty to disorderly conduct, received probation and a fine, and the conviction again was set aside. Mr. Epstein did not immediately respond to requests for comment. Election deniers have not fared well at the polls in Arizona, but they maintain a grip on the state's Republican Party. In January, the party installed a hard-right Trump supporter, Gina Swoboda, as its new leader. Ms. Swoboda runs a nonprofit group that has falsely claimed to have found huge discrepancies in voting records in a number of states. Kari Lake, a fervent backer of Mr. Trump and his false election claims, was the party's candidate for governor in 2022. She lost, and is the leading Republican candidate for a U.S. Senate seat this year. The Arizona Republican Party, in a statement, called the indictment a blatant and unprecedented abuse of prosecutorial power aimed solely at distracting the public ahead of the 2024 election. The United States Supreme Court rejected an appeal on Monday that challenged the state's electronic voting machines. The case was brought by Ms. Lake and Mark Fincham, who lost a 2022 race for Arizona Secretary of State. Having slates of people claiming to be electors for Mr. Trump was an integral part of the effort to keep him in office after his loss at the polls in 2020. Mr. Trump and his allies sought to block or delay congressional certification of Joseph R. Biden Jr.'s victory, hoping that Mr. Trump's allies in the House and Senate might then consider a challenge to the validity of the results in a number of battleground states like Arizona and Michigan, and then accept the pro-Trump electors from those states as valid. In addition to the state cases, Mr. Trump is facing election interference charges himself in the Georgia case and in a federal case brought by Jack Smith, the special prosecutor appointed by the Department of Justice. Mr. Trump has long made a strategy of falsely claiming election fraud. After he was defeated in the 2016 Iowa caucus, he said that Senator Ted Cruz of Texas, the winner of that contest, illegally stole it. And after Mr. Trump received fewer votes nationwide in 2016 than Hillary Clinton did, he said that he had actually won the popular vote, if you deduct the millions of people who voted illegally. Faced with criminal charges in the state elections inquiries, some of Mr. Trump's allies and advisors have backtracked from his 2020 claims. Biden was elected. The process was followed. Kenneth Chesbro, an architect of the fake elector plan, told investigators in Michigan last year. Mr. Chesbro has emerged as a key witness in the state prosecutions. James Renner, a former Michigan state trooper who was a last-minute substitution as a fake elector in that state, expressed regret last year to investigators, stating that he had been walked into a situation that I shouldn't have ever been involved in. Charges against him were dropped as part of a cooperation agreement with the office of Dana Nessel, Michigan's attorney general, a Democrat. Also from the front page, campus protests over Gaza intensify amid pushback by universities and police. By J. David Goodman, David Montgomery, Jonathan Wolf, and Jenna Russell. A wave of pro-Palestinian protests spread and intensified on Wednesday as students gathered on campuses across the country, in some cases facing off with the police, in a widening showdown over campus speech and the war in Gaza. University administrators from Texas to California moved to clear protesters and prevent encampments from taking hold on their own campuses, as they have at Columbia University, deploying police in tense new confrontations that already have led to dozens of arrests. At the same time, new protests continued erupting in places like Pittsburgh and San Antonio. Students expressed solidarity with their fellow students at Columbia and with a pro-Palestinian movement that appeared to be galvanized by the pushback on other campuses and the looming end of the academic year. Protesters on several campuses said their demands included divestment by their universities from companies connected to the Israeli military campaign in Gaza, disclosure of those and other investments, and a recognition of the continuing right to protest without punishment. The demonstrations spread overseas as well, with students on campuses in Cairo, Paris, and Sydney, Australia, gathering to voice support for Palestinians and opposition to the war. As new protests were emerging, the Speaker of the House of Representatives, Mike Johnson, visited the Columbia campus in New York, where university officials were seeking to negotiate with protest leaders to end the encampment of around 80 tents still pitched on a central campus lawn. Mr. Johnson said the school's president, Nima Shafiq, should resign if she could not immediately get the situation under control, calling her an inept leader who had failed to guarantee the safety of Jewish students. The speaker said there could be an appropriate time for the National Guard to be called in, and that Congress should consider revoking federal funding if universities could not keep the protests under control. Republican lawmakers have accused university administrators for months of not doing enough to protect Jewish students on college campuses, seizing on an issue that has sharply divided Democrats. Some of the campus demonstrations that have taken place since the war began last year have included hate speech and expressions of support for Hamas, the armed group based in Gaza that led the deadly attacks on Israel on October 7, sparking the war that has left more than 34,000 people dead in Gaza, according to the Gaza Health Ministry. One of the biggest new protests on Wednesday was in Texas, where dozens of police officers, many of them in riot gear and some of them on horseback, blocked the path of protesters at the state's premier public university, the University of Texas at Austin. At least 34 people were arrested after refusing to disperse, according to a state police spokeswoman. Governor Greg Abbott said that arrests there would continue until the protesters dispersed. "These protesters belong in jail," he wrote on X. "Students joining in hate-filled, anti-Semitic protests at any public college or university in Texas should be expelled." Hours earlier, at the Dallas campus of the University of Texas, a large group of student protesters briefly staged a sit-in near the office of the university president, demanding divestments. The students left after the president agreed to meet with them. At the University of Southern California in Los Angeles, the police moved in just before lunchtime to break up an encampment of about 100 pro-Palestinian protesters at the center of campus. As demonstrators chanted, "Shame," officers tackled at least one protester and put that person into a campus police car, but the protester was later released. Claudia Galliani, 26, a master's student in public policy at USC, said she was protesting to stand in solidarity with the students of Columbia and other campuses across the states who are receiving brutality due to their advocacy for Palestine. She said that the protesters had been ostracized and accused of anti-Semitism. Many USC students were angered at the cancellation of a commencement address by the valedictorian Asna Tabassum, who is Muslim, after complaints from groups on campus that cited her support on social media for Palestinians. "I think universities don't want what's happening on the East Coast to spread to the West Coast," said Maga Miranda, a doctoral student in ethnic studies at the University of California, Los Angeles, who joined the protest at USC. Protesters returned later in the day, but the university prevented a permanent encampment from being established, as the tents that had been forcibly removed in the morning were not re-erected. Just before 6 p.m., Los Angeles Police Department officers ordered them to disperse and threatened them with arrest and expulsion from school. Many protesters moved outside of a police perimeter, but more than two dozen locked arms in the middle of the campus quad, some holding Palestinian flags. Officers ultimately arrested 93 people for trespassing and one person on suspicion of assault with a deadly weapon, LAPD officials announced late Wednesday. Captain Kelly Munoz of the LAPD did not have further details on the assault. By 9 p.m., officers cleared the remaining protesters from the private campus and locked the gates. At Brown University in Rhode Island, scores of students pitched tents on the campus's main green on Wednesday. Organizers said their minds were on the children and students in Gaza, not on the administration's warning that the new encampment violated university policy. They promised to stay until they were forced off. What we're putting on the line is so minimal in risk compared to what Gazans are going through, said Niyanta Nepal, a junior from Concord, New Hampshire, and the president-elect of the student body. This is the least we can be doing as youth in a privileged situation to take ownership of the situation. She said the emergence of a national student movement on college campuses had galvanized brown students. I think everyone was ready to act, and the national momentum was what we needed, she said. Rafi Ash, a sophomore from Amherst, Massachusetts, and a member of Brown University Jews for Ceasefire Now, said the student protesters were in it for the long haul. We'll be here until they divest, or until we're forced off, he said. Administrators at Harvard University sought to head off a similar scene by shuttering Harvard Yard, a central gathering place on campus. But students flooded the yard's grassy patches anyway on Wednesday, rapidly erecting tents as part of an emergency rally against the suspension of a pro-Palestinian campus group. At Cal Poly Humboldt in Arcata, California, administrators said they were shutting down the campus through the weekend, concerned that protesters occupying two buildings could spread to others. Late Tuesday, two students were arrested at Ohio State University, school officials said, during an on-campus protest that has since dispersed. The protests at the University of Texas at Austin were among the first to take place in a Republican-led state in the South, occurring within walking distance of the governor's mansion. Like other Republican political leaders, Governor Greg Abbott has been outspoken in his support for Israel, and last month he vowed to fight any anti-Semitism on campus. University leaders on Tuesday said they had revoked permission for a protest and warned those who might seek to gather anyway. The University of Texas at Austin will not allow this campus to be taken, two administrators from the Office of the Dean of Students wrote in a letter to the Palestine Solidarity Committee. State police were deployed to the campus on Wednesday at the request of the university and at Mr. Abbott's direction, said the state police spokeswoman, Erica Miller, in order to prevent any unlawful assembly. When protesters began to congregate despite the warnings, the response was swift. Scores of officers formed crowd control lines, some clutching batons. After having ordered the protesters to disperse, some officers surged into the crowd and hauled several people away, then returned for others. Let them go, some people shouted as the crowd grew. At one point, hundreds of students and their supporters were gathered on the South Mall of the campus, including some who gathered in a large circle and chanted, "Pigs go home." Soon, the police moved in again, pushing through the crowds and making further arrests. Ms. Miller said the majority of those arrested were charged with criminal trespassing. In a statement, the university's Division of Student Affairs said that the university would not tolerate disruptions like we have seen at other campuses and would take action to allow students to finish their classes and final exams without interruption. That concludes today's reading from the New York Times. My name is Jean, and it's been my pleasure to read for you.